Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, October 17th. From Sin City to Sports City, what can we learn from Las Vegas? Governor Josh Green just returned from there, and we hear more from him this morning. Housing recovery in Maui, still in a very fragile state. We hear from a family that's on the edge of being homeless. And this weekend in France, a hillside town pays homage to the Japanese-American unit who fought to liberate them from the Germans 8 decades ago. And Hawaii's Pride Fest kicks off. We get the lineup from a parade to a party in the park. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, when you hear Sin City, you think casinos, gambling, and, well, Las Vegas. But these days, it's become Sports City, checking all the boxes with football, basketball, baseball, hockey, and wrestling. That's why Governor Josh Green was in Nevada and is now breaking the cardinal rule of Las Vegas that what happens there stays there. He just got back from his Vegas trip and spilled the beans. He talked to us this morning.
You know, this was the end of a three-visit journey. It was Japan, then L.A., and then Las Vegas. And in each stop, it was about economic development. So Japan was more traditional economic development, though we do see opportunities in advance of the 2028 Olympic Games to have some events here, perhaps some training together, and some friendly competitions. So we're going to work on that. And then Los Angeles, we have a deal in place in principle with the Los Angeles Rams to come in and do some of their OTAs, that's the training camps, and then stay and do, you know, lots of positive things in our community. And then finally, over to Las Vegas, you know, I met with the Raiders, who gave us $50,000 for flag football for girls and $25,000 for Cal Hale with HomeAid, that in partnership with Boyd. So I'm working on a really, hopefully, an exciting thing. We're going to propose a homecoming weekend between Las Vegas and Hawaii, where we would have a relationship over at Allegiant Stadium, and we go visit some of our loved ones who are living on the Ninth Island and vice versa in alternate years. It would be something special for Hawaiian Airlines in Alaska. It would be probably a partnership with Boyd, who has a longstanding relationship and a lot of kind of concierge and excellent travel between the islands, and then finally a big game that we could all kind of come back together for. So a lot of ideas were spawned in that trip.
Well, you know, we have watched Las Vegas transform, you know, into a real mecca for sports teams and sports activities. You know, what else can we learn from their experience?
Well, the larger questions remain about gambling and sports book, so I want to be at least at the cutting edge of that. We're not proposing anything new just now at all, but we want to be thoughtful about that. Also, they are a destination, and they've been successful in branding themselves as a destination for events. We could take a page out of that book in some ways. For example, we're successful with the marathon, brings a lot of travel from Japan. I think we can do a lot more, which is why I'm going to keep making sure that we stay on track with the stadium. I'll do all that I can for that. And frankly, their revenue stream is not just gambling anymore. Some of it's the university. So I went and met with the president of UNLV. They do some advanced analytics on gaming and sports and actually a lot of the tourism components of Nevada, Las Vegas. So it's going to be neat, I think, to see what they do, have that relationship. As you know, we also just joined a conference. That's a big deal. Going into the Mountain West means that we're going to have these relationships with about seven other destinations. And that's important to fans of sport, but also for travel purposes. That combined with the new merger with the airline, this is all economically relevant to us. So I wanted to see it firsthand, and there's even a little bonus. The UFC leadership, the Ultimate Fighting competitions, they wanted to see me. And so I met with their president and CEO, and there may very well be a time where we bring some events over here. It turns out we have the densest fan base of any state for UFC. And it's another part of society. So all these things bode well for us going forward.
Well, we do need a facility, though, and I think there's a lot of hand-wringing, you know, for our football team. And, you know, obviously, you know, we've got the Chink Field right now, which is great, but we don't want to see us lose any momentum with getting a new stadium built. I mean, you know, there was excitement about, you know, what can we do for soccer, and, you know, because our folks are doing so well.
It's totally true. And so we want a stadium that can accommodate not just football, but other events. They do about 39 events right now over at Allegiant Stadium, for example. That's far more than the football games that they host. And that's important. I love soccer and rugby. These are sports I played growing up, and the field is conducive to that. We also may very well make a baseball play because this fascination with Shohei Ohtani, who has a property here in Hawaii. He had a monster home run last night. Sorry, Mets fans. And it is interesting. I think you're going to see some resurgence in baseball interest in the Dodgers. So the reason I'm triangulating Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and that whole region is because of that additional fanaticism over a Japanese player that has, you know, roots now in Hawaii. And people don't realize this, but these are billion-dollar industries that could really, you know, they could be that kind of somewhat missing link that we've been looking for. So sports tourism is pretty important. It's, you know, it's just a part of things. We also have healthcare tourism, which we're interested in. We put a new person, as we were talking about, Todd Poe, onto the board. He gives some additional balance. He's got a very good reputation, and he'll work, I hope, very well with Mufi and, you know, the other leadership at the board, Stephanie and so on. So all of these are important pieces, but I was glad to travel there with Jimmy Tokioka, who's my DBED director. He was very passionate about these relationships. And these are all wins for Hawaii, but they take time and constant human touches, which is why I occasionally get over there.
Well, let's talk about, you know, HTA and DBED, because I understand that there was a concern about the budget. You know, HTA wanted more than what Jimmy Tokioka put in the administration's budget.
Yeah, we're still working through the budget. You know, the budget will get finalized in the run-up to the new year. The debate or discussion was between $70 versus $80 million, and you know what I've asked is if we do put monies into budgets like that we see very large returns on investment, and that we're saturating markets in a way that will bring, you know, better travelers and kind of the right travelers into Hawaii. So that's the focus. I'll let those details get sorted out in the coming weeks when I have budget meetings with my director of budget and finance. But again, it's very good for me to get input and different opinions. Our administration is one that actually welcomes some occasional dissent, because I think that sharpens us and people get to make their case of what's going to actually be good for our economy. And that's very important. But that does mean that some people see the sausage being made out in public, and it gives an opportunity for commentary. I'm not at all nervous about that. I've put strong-willed people, as you can see, Jimmy, Mufi Hahnemann, Tata Poe, and so on. We even have a Neil Abercrombie in the mix over at the Regents, and that's a big thing, too, because this week we are doing at least two, if not three, things. We are settling the UPA contract. I did that 8 months early, so that the professors know what their future and salary is. I really respect them. They get the same deal that the teachers got. They're voting on it as we speak, finalizing their vote in the next 24 hours. They also have to choose a president of UH, which has been quite interesting to watch. I did meet both candidates. And then finally, that realignment of the football and sports conferences. So there's a lot going on. And these things will, of course, have a big impact on Hawaii in the future.
Yes, and, you know, on the labor front, you know, when we last talked, we were in the throes of the labor dispute with HPH and the Hawaii Nurses Association. That's been settled. I know there's still some other issues with other hospitals. The hotel workers, I think next week marks a month since they've been walking the line against Hilton.
Yes. In fact, today I'm going to meet with four or five of those hotel workers who are on strike and with their leadership out of respect, hear them in person. I've also talked, of course, to the hotel leadership, and I'm hopeful that they will reach agreement soon. It is very important to us, of course. It's a little different than the hospital package, which had some more technical questions about actually how many patients could be with a client, although there is a with a patient in the hospital. But there is a parallel, of course, because there's a question of how much in the way of rooms the people can care for if they are working at the hotel. So it's a it's kind of a reboot in many ways after the pandemic for all of these disciplines. People are readjusting to the new world, which is a little different, and that includes how we use our hotel rooms and how we prevent infection and so on. So I really love all these guys, and I always encourage them to settle. I'm here to help with mediation, and we use the federal mediators, which I recommended, the Attorney General and I recommended, and that settled the differences with the nurses. So we can do that again. I prefer to just do these things quietly where there's no one yelling at each other, because we're all ohana after these disputes occur. And we're not going anywhere, so it's better not to get into big-time personal conflict.
And, this push for sports tourism, I mean, we have seen the activity pick up over at the Hawaii Convention Center, right? We're, keeping our fingers crossed that we get, new bookings for outside conventions coming in. But in the meantime, we do have an effort. I think the latest was to put up a pickleball tournament over there at the convention center. So I know Terry Orton's trying to get creative.
Yes. Hey, man, everyone loves pickleball teams. I even saw Agassi playing Macron on a pickleball court, and I almost lost it. So I think it's great. Populations are increasing in age a little bit, especially in destination sites, and pickleball is a little easier to manage than tennis or golf. So whatever makes people happy. It's been a tough couple years. And so, if our happiness quotient needs to be tended to, then we should do it with pickleball and sports and of course everything else that's amazing about Hawaii, like our beaches and parks. Look for those kind of solutions to be put into place, even more free public events. I think that we're going to even host a Halloween party and movie night on the lawn at Washington Place in the coming weeks. I haven't seen the final decision from Jamie, but I'm pretty sure that that's going to happen, and we're going to take we're going to put out some kind of sign up for it, and it'll be free, of course, and let people just do good things together.
So we get the scoop on that one, huh?
Yeah, it is a scoop, and we'll show some kind of scary movie, I hope. So it's just people deserve to have some gentle time, and people have been working really hard to stay afloat. It's going to still take a little more time. The big pieces of making Hawaii more affordable, part one went into place where we're going to really slash taxes on working families. They're going to deeply be cut. 71% is going to be the decrease in state tax. So that's a big deal. That starts on January 1. And then the other part is going to take time, and that's getting enough housing built so that we have an inventory so people aren't paying these crazy, rental rates. So over time, this is going to be a transformative period for our state. In the meanwhile, we'd like to do some nice things like sports, like free movies, like making sure that the beaches don't get overrun by too many travelers. All those things, I think, mean something to people.
All right. Okay. Well, Josh Green, hope you're over your jet lag. But thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Governor Josh Green talking to us earlier today. He just returned from Las Vegas to learn more about its rise as a sports destination and how we can apply strategies to boost our place in the sports world.
World, the Arctic is getting a lot of international attention. Indigenous people there are making sure their voices are heard amid the global chatter.
For people who live in the Arctic, this is our home, and we need to be part of those discussions.
The U.S. government just created a new position of Arctic Ambassador at Large. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaiian Humane Society, announcing its 34th annual Pet Walk, a community event benefiting Oahu's pets in need, October 26th at Kapi'olani Park. Registration at hawaiianhumane.org.
On the edge. Recovery after the wildfires is happening on Maui, but that's not to say that housing safety nets can catch everybody. Here to talk about this is HPR reporter Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what's the situation that you found out there?
Well, you know, it's an ongoing housing crisis, as we've heard so much about on Maui. According to a recent UH Economic Research Organization study, households impacted by the fire are paying an average of 43% more rent for the same or fewer bedrooms compared with before the wildfire. And that's just relating to folks who were directly impacted by the fire, but that's really something that folks are talking about across the board, whether or not they were directly impacted. Today we're talking about a family that was not materially impacted by the fire, but still experiencing the ripple effects and struggling in this impossible housing market on Maui. Mo'i Kava'akoa, and four other people in her household had rented the same house in Pukalani for the last 7 years, and now she's on the brink of being houseless. And here's Kava'akoa explaining how this happened.
I was renting this home for the past 7 years. And the reason we actually had to vacate the property was because my landlord is displaced from Lahaina. She has a home in Kahoma Village, but she did not qualify for FEMA because it is still intact, but undergoing remediation and repairs because it showed high levels of toxicity. And she just had a newborn baby in June. So because she didn't qualify for FEMA, she had to use her homeowner's insurance to pay the high rent there in Lahaina. And that actually ran out end of September, her homeowner's insurance. So they were trying to find something within their budget. They couldn't find anything. So the next thing was moving up to the Pukalani property that she owns. And I live in the bigger home. I live in the main home, the three-bedroom. And she has her family now. So that's how we ended up in this situation.
Yeah, it sounds pretty tough.
So it's just this ripple effect going across all of Maui. And even though a lot of studies we've been hearing about lately examine fire-affected folks versus non-fire-affected folks directly, kind of looking at them separately, there's really so much overlap when we're talking about the housing market on Maui. Everybody is affected and connected. And for Kava'akoa, she says she would have been homeless and had already decided where she was going to take her family to stay in a tent. They were able to stay temporarily with someone, and they're a family of five. There are four income earners in her family. And so in her particular case, the rent isn't so much of an issue as it is for so many people. But they started looking for housing in July, and she applied for more than 50 homes. She spoke to five or six different realtors. I mean, she's been doing everything that she possibly can to find a place. They have three large dogs, and so that's been a challenge to find a place that accommodates that. They had two prospective homes that both fell through at the last minute for different reasons. Here is Nicole Ugunin. She's co-director of Maui Rapid Response. She's also happens to be the person that Kava'akoa's Ohana is staying with right now. And here she is describing the situation that so many people are facing right now.
Being the person and our staff that literally has to walk people into homelessness or choose to put them up in our homes, like we're not getting any rest. And we're sitting there in the emotions of people that never even thought that they would come close to homelessness, right? Like they were sitting pretty in their four-person ohana with one dog, with maybe one baby on the way, and they got two cush jobs. And then next thing you know, their landlord raises the rent 1 year, $500. And so they have to scramble a little bit. And then the next year, the landlord calls and says, actually, we're going to renovate and sell the house. You're out. And then they come into the market and there's nothing there for them that they can afford or that fits their family. And then now they're looking like they spend months. They crash on friends' houses. They maybe stay at an Airbnb for a week, but they get to a point where after you do that for 2 or 3 months, which that is part of the problem, it's taking a minimum of 3 months to find a new place. Minimum, you know, a 45-day notice doesn't cover that. Like to be with a person when a family that has done everything right have to make the decision to leave island or to like crash at a Lualo campground and then hope and pray that something comes up. It's happening every single week, every single week. And there are times of the year that it's happening every single day. It's awful. It's really scary out here.
Yeah. Your heart goes out to these families in this situation. It's tough.
Yeah, and Ugandan says, you know, it's just tearing families apart. There's a lot of finger pointing among agencies, a lot of talk, but not a lot of action at this point. And, you know, at the end of the day, people are being told, you know, you should be working harder. You should get better paying jobs when they're already working 2 or 3 jobs, you know, just trying to keep their head above water. And, you know, she's housing people like Mo'i because she knows that once families go, you know, live on the streets, go into houselessness, it becomes so much harder for them to come back from that. And so she's, you know, personally doing everything she can, as an organization doing everything they can. And, you know, just across the board, there's just so much, you know, really urgency and feeling of helplessness. So, you know, rent controls, increasing state assistance, you know, EBT, HUD levels to reflect rising costs. Those are some of the things that people are talking about would help in this situation. You know, not being able, you know, making just a slight bit more than the HUD requirements, getting kicked off that system, you know, it's just a cycle of poverty, as Kava'akoa says. What about the governor's emergency proclamation that's supposed to be covering evictions and helping with these rent increases? Here's what Ugandan says about it.
I think the proclamation is a small band-aid. It's like the little band-aid that goes on your knuckle. I think we need like a 4x4 gauze pad proclamation, and then the regulatory agencies need to be beefed up to be able to respond at a 4x4 gauze pad level, because we're hemorrhaging. So there needs to be multiple people holding down that gauze pad as if we are in an emergency room triaging a major emergency. And that's not what is happening here. What we're happening here is we have a person handing over the tiniest band-aid to a person that is facing eviction. And I don't even like that word eviction. Like, there's got to be a better word, because eviction also has this connotation that the renter did something wrong. And most of the time, they did not. They just, like, are being told, like, oh, the house needs to be renovated. The house is going to be sold. Oh, my brother is moving in from the mainland. I think that the proclamations could do even better, and they're still not the solution. The proclamations are the band-aids, so to get us time to actually come up with a comprehensive solution.
Yeah, and I don't know if the family that you talked to, if they considered even splitting up, you know, if they can't get a large enough place. It's tough.
It is, and I know some families are considering that. But part of the issue that everybody's talking about, too, is lack of regulation. As Ugandan mentioned, you know, there is this wildfire emergency proclamation that continues to be extended for 2 months at a time, but there's not really a system of regulation that's set to back that up. And even the county, considering rate stabilization bills, you know, a lack of regulation are just hurdles that they're, you know, looking at as far as budget and staff and all of those things. So it's really a big problem at this point.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine. We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel about the housing situation on Maui.
HPR is a unifier, a place where we can come together to stay informed, learn about our world, and experience music that feeds the soul. You can secure this resource for future generations when you include HPR in your will or estate plan. It's a simple but profound way to give, and an enduring investment in the future of this station. For more information about giving a gift through your will, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
While the presidential race is getting most of the attention, control of several key state legislatures is also up for grabs, and here's why it matters.
When there's such gridlock at the federal level, like, policy really gets done within the states. And you see that recognition among a lot of national groups. They are pouring more money into the states than they ever have before.
I'm Anthony Brooks. The key contest for legislative majorities. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Years ago, two young Hawaii soldiers from the decorated 442nd Regimental Combat Team, 100th Infantry Battalion, Staff Sergeant Tomiso Hirahira and Private First Class Yoshio Tengwan died in battle, liberating Bruere, a French hillside town in France. The motto of the segregated unit, go for broke. They will be remembered at the American Cemetery at Epinal this week, and attending the ceremony will be former Hawaii Congressman Charles DeJoux, who for the last 2 years has served as Secretary of the American Battle Monuments Commission. He sat down with us before heading across the globe to talk about the importance of marking the World War II battles. We last talked with him this summer as world leaders gathered at Normandy for the 80th anniversary of the beginning of the end of the war.
June of 1944 was the landings over in western France and the Normandy beaches. This coming October was the push from the beaches of western France to eastern France. And of course, right after this, well, then the Allies, the United States and its allies, push on into Germany. There's the Battle of the Bulge. And then finally, of course, the toppling of Hitler in April 1945 and victory in Europe in May of 1945. This particular celebration that we're looking forward to hosting with my agency, the American Battle Monuments Commission, is the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Bayeux and Epinal, the adjacent town over in eastern France. And it's particularly special because it was the 100th Battalion and the 442nd Infantry Regiment that liberated this town. The Japanese Americans, many of which came from Hawaii, liberated these communities over in eastern France.
And there are two Hawaii soldiers that are buried there, from what I understand.
Yes, yes. They're soldiers who were with the 442nd Infantry Regiment, made the ultimate sacrifice. They aren't the only 442nd. There are several other Japanese-American soldiers, but they were from California or other parts of the United States. And they are buried in the Epinal American Cemetery, which is the town immediately adjacent to Bayeux over in eastern France.
Yeah, so this anniversary then is a big deal. Usually a number of people, you know, from Hawaii will make the trek, you know, whether the sons and daughters of the 442nd.
Yes.
But yeah, maybe share with our listeners details or stories about that particular battle.
This is particularly significant. It was the Allies' push to get into Germany and topple Hitler. And the 442nd, the Japanese American unit, was sent right to the front to confront the Nazis. It was in this particular point in the 442nd's history, there was a so-called Lost Battalion. It was a infantry battalion from Texas that got completely surrounded by the Nazis, and they would have been completely wiped out and all of the Americans slaughtered. But the 442nd pushed to open up and free them. And it's part of today the 442nd Infantry Regiment's lore that they went in and saved this Texas Infantry Battalion. For me, being from Hawaii, I think this is something that I think all of us from the islands can be particularly proud of. This is part of our heritage, is part of our history. It shows how the world is so incredibly connected. It's connected through history. It's connected through all points of the globe. With this one, of course, it was principally the Nisei soldiers whose parents originally came from Japan, settled in places like Hawaii or California or Washington State, going on to fight in France against the Nazis in Germany. And so this is this incredible multinational, multi-ethnic connections from Japan, the United States, France, Germany. There's lots of amazing stories how when the 442nd originally liberated these French villages, the French villagers were a little bit confused in the sense that, they had been under Nazi oppression for half a dozen years. Finally, the Nazis get ousted. They can taste freedom. But when they come outside, they see a whole bunch of Japanese Americans. And they were confused because they were like, from their perspective, well, the Nazis were allied with Japan. Why are all these Japanese here all of a sudden? Not really realizing or understanding they're Japanese Americans, not from Imperial Japan. And so I think this is particularly special. And, I'd like, Catherine, your listeners to note and understand that this history, which I am saddened is sometimes forgotten here in our home state of Hawaii, is still remembered very fondly in France. The French people remember the liberation done by the United States, done by these Japanese American soldiers to this day. Indeed, for this particular ceremony coming up later on this week, the French elementary school teachers are having the students learn how to fold Japanese cranes. And the elementary school students are folding Japanese cranes. They're making them into Hawaiian leis. And they're placing a lei of Japanese origami cranes on all of the crosses of all the Japanese American soldiers at Epinal American Cemetery.
And that's going to be part of that whole ceremony.
Yes, that's going to be part of all the ceremony. Yes. So it's particularly special. I mean, the French teachers are very excited to teach their young students about Japan, Japanese history, Japanese culture, but also, of course, critically American history and what the United States did to liberate that community from Nazi oppression.
Well, we recently were able to meet with some of the French students who came here from that town, and they were blown away at the history of, the whole Japanese story here. And it was nice to see that generation have that deeper appreciation for what happened with their town.
Yes. If anything, Catherine, I mean, I'm thrilled and absolutely delighted that these French students in Eastern France continue to remember this history. Their teachers continue to teach the importance of this history. My slight sadness is there's too few Americans who understand our own American history, and it's sometimes a bit frustrating for me that from my position, I too often find French or Dutch or Belgian nationals understanding American history and American sacrifice better than Americans do. So this is something that I think for us in our country that we should maybe work on just a little bit.
Well, I'm told that there are streets like named Honolulu, named after places here in Hawaii.
Yes.
So it just shows that they feel that we're a part of their town.
Yes. And actually, if I can note something neat over in the town of Bayou, after the Second World War, then Honolulu Mayor Neil Blaisdell went over and paid homage to the sacrifice of the 442nd. And yes, Neil Blaisdell is remembered fondly over in Eastern France for his connection with France. And again, I think for a lot of Hawaii people, when you say Neil Blaisdell, what comes to mind is the concert arena. People say, you're going to a concert or something. But in France, it's a recognition of the former Honolulu mayor, his connection, his work to make sure the Japanese-American sacrifice is not forgotten over in France. So yes, I mean, they're this Hawaii connection over in rural Eastern France that I think a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah, and we have a sister city relationship. And, I know that we had featured the council general. He had shared that the students in this town composed a song in homage to, what the 442nd soldiers did in the war. And,
yes.
And
yes.
So, yeah, those connections run deep.
Yes. And, you know, it's something else I want to just add and have your listeners understand, and that is how profound, how unique, how really this speaks to the very best of our nation and speaks to the best of the American people. And that is, so much of European history is about wars and conquests and kings and lords fighting with one another, constantly seeking to expand their fiefdoms. What's different about our nation, the United States? I think what's different about this actions of the 442nd is they went all the way on the other side of the world, fought valiantly, bravely, courageously. So many of them died making the ultimate sacrifice. And we didn't ask for anything in return. The United States of America didn't go there to seize land. We didn't go there to take from other people. We certainly didn't go there to enslave vast swaths of the French or German population. We went there for the very best of America, the principles that we as a nation believe in, freedom and liberty and democracy. And that's what we went to fight for. And it was a fight that I realize American history isn't perfect. And I think that the history of the 442nd shows some of that imperfection of America. But I think it reflects also the very best of our nation and the best of what it means to be an American. And so to all of your listeners, I encourage you, if one day you should have the time, please come out to France, see what America has done, see what the 442nd, see what Hawaii kids did and did for the cause of the very best of humanity and the very best of American values. That is, fight for freedom and democracy, not fighting for enslavement or plunder or fighting for more land for a lord. There's a lot of problems. There's a lot of things I think that divide Americans today, especially with the election coming up in a few weeks. But this is one of the things that's really pure and noble and good about America and our nation and our country. And it's something I think Americans, something that Hawaii people should rightly feel very proud of.
And, you know, you have military service in your background. Mm-hmm. You're still with the Army Reserves. What is it that reaches into your heart, mm-hmm. you know, now that you are in this job in D.C.?
You know, it's a lot of things. For me, it's a reminder that I know for so many people, for a lot of us here, I mean, you know, on a day-to-day basis, you're worried about, what are you doing at work, trying to get your paycheck, or worrying about groceries, picking up the kids from school and whatnot. But for me, when I go to these amazing sites of the American Battle Monuments Commission, when I see the service and sacrifice of our nation around the world, it is a reminder that there's an inner goodness in America, that our nation really truly is a unique country, different, separate, and apart from every other nation in this world. And I know it's so easy to get disappointed in America today. And I get it that so many Americans, they look at social media and the banality of cat videos on TikTok or something like that. But this is a good reminder that America, we still have it. We Americans still stand for something that is just different from the rest of this world, that we as a nation don't stand for a king or a crown or a sect or a denomination, that we are a nation that can stand on ideas. And these are noble ideas of freedom, of democracy, and that we as a nation are willing to sacrifice our young for these principles. And that's something that's really, really different about our country. And for me, with my service in the military, it's a good, humbling reminder of why we serve, why it's a noble cause to be part of America and be part of America's service.
All right. Well, Charles DeJoux, we really appreciate you coming down and spending some of your time with us.
Yes, thank you, Catherine. It's an absolute delight. And, you know, if I can just put a quick plug in, if any of your listeners, if you don't have the time to come visit any of the American Battle Monument Commission sites around the world, please do visit us on abmc.gov. All of our sites are there. We have 26 American cemeteries, 31 memorials spread around 17 countries around the world, not just France, but also Italy, Tunisia, Mexico, Philippines. Please visit our site. And certainly, of course, all of your listeners, and yes, including you, Catherine, come and visit us. Come and visit us real soon. If not in person, then at least on the web.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Charles.
Thanks so much. It's a delight. Yeah. Mahalo.
That was Charles Dejoux, Secretary of the American Battle Monuments Commission. He's heading to France to commemorate the 80th anniversary of a battle in Brière, won thanks to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, 100th Infantry Battalion, which was a unit comprised of all Japanese-American soldiers.
Join HPR for an in-person celebration of storytelling and music. Save the date to hear from Kate Tellers of The Moth Radio Hour and Boots Lupe Nui of Kohala Mountain Music Project. This event is on Saturday, October 26th from 12:30 p.m. at HPR's Atherton Studio in Honolulu. Seating is limited. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org.
When you support HPR, you support locally produced programs featuring locally produced music, including Kani Kapila Sunday.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kani Kapila Sunday. I'm Kaylee Iloma, and I'm so happy to be with you again on a Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. to offer you great Hawaiian music from all periods.
Hawaii Kula Iwi.
Aloha nui kako. You are tuned in to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio 1's Hawaii Kula Iwi. Ovo no ke yo, DJ Mermaid, Paige Okamura.
And Mauka Tumakai.
This is Mauka Tumakai. I'm your host, Roger Bong.
Your support brings the music of Hawaii to the world. Support Hawaiian and local music programs on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Home of the Tigers, McKinley High, and Modern Art includes work by Satoru Abe, Imai Kalani Kalahele, Ralph Iwamoto, and more. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Thousands of people are expected to celebrate our diversity and participate in the Honolulu Gay Pride Parade and Festival this weekend. The parade will begin at Ala Moana Park starting at 4 p.m. Saturday and will proceed along Kalakaua Avenue and end at Kapi'olani Park. A festival with activities for keiki and kapuna takes place at the Waikiki Shell. Parties and other events are also planned throughout the weekend. Zabrina Zablon Duvichel is the Honolulu Pride Chair. She talked to HPR's Jason Ubai about this year's festivities, including the parade.
It will be led by Grand Marshals Dr. David McEwen, Sherry Mann, David Brustein, Puakea Nogemeyer, and Bill Shar, which are the five founding members of our organization. We expect over 4,000 participants, including several floats, bands, trolleys, and walkers from businesses, nonprofit organizations, social groups, and government agencies. Starting at 5 p.m., though, everyone is invited over to the Honolulu Pride Festival, which is going to be held at the Waikiki Shell, where attendees will enjoy performances by headliners Marina Summers and Nymphia Wind from the World of Wonders RuPaul's Drag Race, as well as Neighbor Island Pride Groups and so many other amazing entertainers that will be there on the main stage. We also have booths with information from our community partners and food and drinks, of course.
Why is it being held in the evening this time?
So it's being held in the evening because for the last few years, we've always held it in the daytime. And the number one thing that most of our attendees say is it is so hot. Of course, you know, October, we don't really experience all of the seasons. And so it's still warm in October. And so we wanted to create an experience where participants would be able to enjoy all of the festivities while still staying cool. So it's our first twilight evening situation, and we're really excited for it because that just means that we get to do fun light shows and really fun installations that you can't see in the daytime.
I know Honolulu is a little bit of an outlier by having the Pride Parade in October. Why is it different? Why does Honolulu celebrate in October versus June?
Yeah, so most people are familiar with Pride Month in June, which coincides with the 1969 Stonewall Uprising. This was a series of protests and confrontations between police and LGBTQ activists, which paved the way for progress in LGBTQ activism, marriage equality, and acceptance by the wider community. For us here on Oahu and in Hawaii, we do recognize and celebrate Pride in the month of June, but we also celebrate it in the month of October to coincide with the LGBT History Month, National Coming Out Day, which is actually on October 11th, and Spirit Day, which is the third Thursday in October.
Can you talk a bit more about where the Honolulu Pride has come from and where do you see it going with this event and into the future?
Yeah, so part of the reason why our Grand Marshals this year are our founding members is because we wanted to really hone in on where we started and kind of give honor and homage to the folks who really paved the way so that our organization can be the organization that you see today. I think in the years that were before this, a lot of the initiatives and fight that our organization was striving for was a lot to do with marriage equality, which was something that our state was one of the first states to really sign into office marriage equality. And so there's a deep, rich history here within the Hawaiian chain that has to do with marriage equality. And so I think that was the starting point for that. And the five founding members really paved the way for us to be able to have celebrations like we do today, where we're not necessarily fighting the fight as much, but we are able to celebrate our existence. Now, I can't say that that means that there is nothing to fight about. One of the things that we as an organization today are still working towards is the Vote Yes on One initiative, which really is going to protect marriage equality for all, and something that even today, 30 years later, after we're celebrating the existence of those bills that were first created here in Hawaii, is something that we're still working towards for marriage equality. So while we're present day able to celebrate and have more equity within the communities that we are a part of, we are still fighting that fight, and that's still something that's at the forefront for us. For the future, though, when we're looking towards the future and what's to come, I think initiatives like having the Ohana Village or things that show keiki what it means to be unapologetically themselves and just be autonomous within their own bodies and selves, I think really that's what the future looks like, right? The future really is our next generation and seeing what LGBTQ and just queerness as a whole looks like through their eyes. And so uplifting those voices, creating more opportunities for our keiki to learn from our kupuna and really know where our history has come from.
What do you wish attendees know before they come to this event?
Yeah, so, you know, events like this, they are for everyone. We want to include all folks to be able to participate in these events. But really what we always want to make very clear is that these are safe spaces for communities to kind of coexist together, whether that you are a part of the LGBTQ community or if you are just an ally. Allies play a huge, strong role for us. And so we want to make sure that, you know, we are creating safe spaces for all to feel included, to be able to celebrate what it means to be queer and just really gather as a whole. I think just the number one thing that we want as an organization to really instill is just that Pride for us is a celebration, but it's also a form of activism too. You know, it's a way for us to really stake our claim here. And we've been very fortunate to have support from our local leaders and folks who have supported us over the years. We actually just last week had a event over at the Frank Fossey building where they rose the pride flag to mark the start of Honolulu Pride Month and declare the rainbow shower tree as the official pride tree of Honolulu, which is really special. And so that support of the allies really is what helps us be able to push forward our message as an organization.
With allies, mentioned a few things, but how does that look like? How can allies support folks respectfully?
Yeah, so, you know, events like this, they are for everyone. We want to include all folks to be able to participate in these events. But really what we always want to make very clear is that these are safe spaces for communities to kind of coexist together, whether that you are a part of the LGBTQ community or if you are just an ally. Allies play a huge, strong role for us. And so we want to make sure that, you know, we are creating safe spaces for all to feel included, to be able to celebrate what it means to be queer and just really gather as a whole. I think just the number one thing that we want as an organization to really instill is just that Pride for us is a celebration, but it's also a form of activism too. You know, it's a way for us to really stake our claim here. And we've been very fortunate to have support from our local leaders and folks who have supported us over the years.
It is a presidential election year. Why is Pride important, as these issues are may not be as controversial here, but certainly nationwide conversation about LGBTQ plus rights and issues?
So with us being in an election year, I think that anytime a new president is coming into play, we always are mindful of what that means for us as a community. I talked about it earlier. Our initiative with the Vote Yes on One is something that we as an organization are really in support of. It's a constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot this election year that will protect same-sex marriage in Hawaii. It removes discriminatory language in our state constitution that gives legislature the authority to reverse marriage for opposite-sex couples. And so when we're looking at years like election years, the number one thing that we're looking at is really how it affects us in our community and what we can do to help create those protections like our predecessors have done in the past. You know, for those folks who, like the founding members who did this fight initially, you know, our fight continues on here. And so we're looking at those election years. And of course, I would be remiss to say that knowing who our two candidates are, there is the sense of nervousness that I have personally as somebody who's actually, my profession is in the wedding industry. Knowing that this is something that could be on the docket is something that is very close to myself. And so I think that, you know, when we're looking at it as an org, we're looking at it from the perspective of us just creating safe guidelines, safe measures, and just continuing to fight to make everybody feel included and equitable.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Pride Chair Zabrina Zablon Duvichel. She was talking with HPR's Jason Ubai about this Saturday's parade and festival in Waikiki. We'll have a link to more information about all the Pride events this weekend on the conversation page of our website after the show. Well, it's almost high noon, so we're out of time. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show for you, showcasing family fun. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.